Last week we started looking at the life of Joseph, the favorite son of Jacob, the grandson of Isaac, the great-grandson of Abraham. And we've been tracking that family history over the last few weeks. And we looked at the first half of the story of Joseph. Today we're going to look at the rest of it and as well conclude the book of Genesis. A quick recap of last week, though, to kind of catch us up, since we're going to pick up in the middle of the story. Let's remind ourselves of what the story is so far. The story of Joseph begins in chapter 37 of Genesis, and starts out with Joseph being, in verse 2, a young man of 17, and we see he didn't get along with his brothers very well. In verses 3 and 4, it says that Israel, which was a name that God had given to Jacob, Joseph's father. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he had been born to him in his old age and because he was the firstborn son of his favorite wife, of the wife that he really wanted, Rachel. Okay, that's an insert there. And Jacob, or Israel, made a richly ornamented robe for him. And when his brother saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. The point of this robe was a sign of love, but it was also a big billboard that Joseph walked around wearing, showing everyone that, hey, I'm Dad's favorite kind of thing. So as a result, his brothers hated him because he was the favorite son. Now, you would hope that Joseph would try to be very careful and not contribute to that, but we see some instances where he did. In verse 2, we see that he was tending the flocks with his brothers. Now, these, not all of his brothers, but the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. So he did a tattletale when he was 17 years old, and that obviously made the sons of Zilpah and Bilhah, four of his brothers, very much more upset with him. Then verses 5 to 11, we see that he had a couple of dreams. In verses 5 through 7, we see that his first dream had to deal with he and his brothers were out binding sheaves of grain, and his sheaf stood up, upright, and all the brothers' sheaves gathered around and bowed down to it. The meaning of that dream was very clear to his brothers. In verse 8, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule over us?" And they hated him all the more because of the dream and because of what he had said. You would think he'd learn from that, but he had another dream. And not only did he have another dream, but verse 9, he had another dream and he told it to his brothers. Come on, Joseph. You saw where that got you last time. And this time he tells him the dream that the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to him this time. Well, that was clear to his brothers what he was saying there, as well as his father. This time, when he told his father as well in verse 10, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" Okay? And his brothers were jealous of him. So we see that his brothers hated him for many reasons. Number one, he was Dad's favorite, and that was advertised. That was clear to everybody. He was specially treated in many ways, we see as we get further into the story. We see that he was a tattletale on his brothers, better than them kind of thing too. We see that he thought he was better and he had these dreams and told them to his brothers about how his brothers would serve him and bow down to him. And so they were upset. You go on into the story and you see that his brothers were out shepherding the sheep and the flocks. And Joseph wasn't, but his dad sent him to go check up on him. He tracked him down. And all this time they had been stewing, and their hatred towards Joseph was getting worse and worse. So finally, when they see him, their first thought is, "We got to get rid of this problem. Let's get rid of him. We're out in the middle of nowhere. We can get rid of him." So they made plans to kill him and take his robe and put some blood on it and make it look like some ferocious animal had killed him and take that back to Dad. Well, Reuben, the oldest, stood up for Joseph and said, "Hey, he's our brother. Let's don't kill him. Let's just throw him in this pit, leave him to die, and we won't have to kill him." And they said, okay. So they did that. Reuben's plan was to go back and pull him out of the pit and take him back home to save his brother. Well, as they were there. A caravan of Ishmaelites was going on their way to Egypt, and the brothers of Judah kind of stood up and said, "Hey, let's not leave them here to die. Let's let them live. Let's sell them to these Ishmaelites and let them be a slave. He'll at least live this way." So they did that. They sold them to the Ishmaelites. Reuben went back to the pit later, and there was no Joseph. So he was all upset because he was the responsible one. "What am I going to tell Dad now?" Well, they took his robe, they put blood on it, cut it up, and gave it to Joseph. And we see that in verses 31 to 34. They got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the blood in it. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to bits." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. People tried to comfort him, but he would not be comforted. And said in verse 35, "I will go down to my grave mourning for my son." So you see, he was very upset at the loss of this favorite son that he loved so much. Well, but Joseph wasn't dead. Okay, his brothers made it look like he was dead, and for all intents and purposes, he was dead to his family, he was dead to his father, he was dead to his brothers, he was gone. He was in Egypt. When he went to Egypt, he was sold as a slave. His purchaser happened to be a high-ranking Egyptian official by the name of Potiphar. He was a captain of the guard for Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, so very high-ranking, very powerful man. In charge of the prisons, in charge of the guards. But God was with him. God was with Joseph. Even though he was a slave, even though he had been hated by and rejected and sold as a slave, almost killed by his brothers, God was with him. Even though he was a slave, he prospered, verse 2, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that Yahweh was with him and that Yahweh gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything that he owned. And we see this Midas touch now, that everything that Joseph touches, he meets with success. And so things go very well for Potiphar. His household is blessed. And so Potiphar puts everything in Joseph's care, doesn't worry about anything except for the food that he eats. We see that in verse 6. And that's because it was a disgrace to Egyptians to eat with Semites or Hebrews, which Joseph was. So he concerned himself with his food because it would be unclean for the Hebrew to touch his food and to deal with his food. But with everything else, though, he left in Joseph's care. That high trust depends on someone who's trustworthy, and Joseph was trustworthy. However, Potiphar's wife was not, and she took a liking to Joseph. He was a good-looking, handsome, well-built man, and she tried to seduce him many, many times. He refused her advances and refused her offers, and that upset her. Finally, she caught him in the house by himself one time without any of the other servants around, and she grabbed a hold of his coat and said, "Come to bed with me." And he took off running, left his coat behind, and got out of there. He had been doing everything he could to even stay away from her so that there wouldn't be that temptation. Being scorned, being rejected again like this, she had the coat in her hands, and she screamed, and she yelled rape. She accused him of rape. She told all the servants that. When Potiphar came back home, she told him the story. Potiphar was very upset. We don't know whether he was upset that Joseph might have done something like this, in other words, that he believed his wife, or that he was upset that his wife had made up the story, if he knew her well enough to recognize this. We kind of see the latter, because he throws Joseph in prison, but he throws him into the king's prison, which is a light duty. It's not a very tough prison, but it's a prison nonetheless. It's a dungeon, and even the nicest prisons in those days were nothing you'd want to be a part of. But he throws him into the king's prison. In the king's prison, we see the same sort of successes that Joseph saw before, that he starts to get a little bit of responsibility, and the warden, everything that Joseph touches is met with success. The warden gives more and more responsibility to Joseph. Joseph is blessed. The warden is blessed. And verse 23, the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because Yahweh was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. So the warden, verse 22, put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for everything that was done there. So he rose up in the ranks of prisoner to the highest level that a prisoner could have and had a lot of responsibility because God was with him. Now that kind of put him in a place where God could reach out to him and his situation could change again. We see in chapter 40 that Pharaoh got upset with a couple of the most trusted servants that he had, the chief baker and the chief cupbearer. Both of these people had to be very well trusted because they were responsible for making sure that Pharaoh didn't eat or drink anything that would kill him, poisonous or otherwise. So something happened to where he didn't trust them, so he threw them both into prison until he could figure out what the situation was. Apparently one of them, something must have happened. Well, while they were in prison, they came under Joseph's care. They were assigned to Joseph. While they were in prison under Joseph, they both had dreams. And they woke up and they didn't have the happy, they looked upset to Joseph. And so he said, "What's wrong?" And they said, "Well, we both had dreams and we can't figure out what they mean." He said, "Well, I can't interpret dreams, but God can. So tell me your dreams and maybe God will interpret your dreams through me for you." So they tell him the dreams. And basically, they each have their own dream, and the chief cupbearer has this dream, and Joseph tells him, "Well, what your dream means is that in 3 days you're going to be released, and Pharaoh is going to give you your job back, and you're going to be chief cupbearer to Pharaoh again." The chief baker hears that and says, "Oh, well, let me tell you my dream." And he tells him his dream, and Joseph goes, "Well, yours isn't as good. You're going to be released in 3 days, just like the chief cupbearer, but Pharaoh's going to hang you, and you're going to die, and the birds are going to come eat your flesh. And that's what your dream means." And sure enough, 3 days later, exactly what Joseph said happened. Pharaoh threw a party. It was his birthday. He brought these guys out of prison, lifted them up to the people at his party, and restored the chief cupbearer, but hanged the chief baker. Joseph saw that there was a purpose to this. And verse 14, he says, talking to the chief cupbearer, "When all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison." Okay, because I was forcefully carried away from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I've done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon. So God's brought you here and given you this dream and given me the ability to tell you the interpretation of it so that you can then mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this place. So that's what Joseph saw the purpose here is. Well, we see in verse 23 that after the chief cupbearer was put back in his job, the chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. And Joseph continued to stay in prison for another year or two, at least. All this time, everything's going against him. His brothers hated him. His brothers tried to kill him. His brothers sold him as a slave. He was a slave. He did well as a slave, but then he was thrown in prison because he was wrongly accused of doing something he didn't do. Now in prison, he had the opportunity to get out, but he's not remembered, and nothing happens. And all he sees is a future of living the rest of his life in that prison. And that's the best he could hope for. But God has other plans for him. We see in chapter 41 that 2 full years later, Pharaoh had a dream. Okay, and actually he has 2 dreams. He's got this dream dealing with these fat and skinny cows, and then this dream dealing with these fat and skinny heads of wheat. And in both cases, the fat ones come up, there's 7 of them, and then there's 7 skinnies that come up and eat the fat, and the skinnies still look skinny. And Pharaoh had these dreams that bothered him. He tried to get some interpretations from his wise men and magicians, and no one could understand what those dreams meant. No one could give him explanations. And then we see that the chief cupbearer, "Oh, you know, Pharaoh, I meant to tell you something. 2 years ago, you threw me in prison, and there was this guy who interpreted my dream and the chief baker's dream, and what he said those dreams were saying everything happened exactly as what he said. Well, Pharaoh says, well, bring him to me. I want him to listen to my dream. So they cleaned up Joseph, brought him to Pharaoh. Pharaoh told him the dreams. Joseph, in turn, said, well, Pharaoh, this is what your dreams mean. They're both the same dreams. And the fact that you have two dreams that are saying the same thing, that tells you for sure this is going to happen, that God has decided this and nothing is going to change this. And what's going to happen is that you're going to have 7 years throughout all of Egypt of plenty. You're going to grow more crops than you ever have. You're going to be very abundant. But then those are going to be followed by 7 lean years, 7 years of famine. And those 7 years of famine are going to be so strong that those 7 years of abundance are going to be forgotten. Okay, they'll gobble up everything in those 7 years of abundance. So God's shown you this, God's told you this, so that you can make preparations now, that you can go get somebody to start putting together a program and save up, say, 20% of all the grain that's raised in Egypt over the next 7 years, so that when the 7 years of famine come, you've got something to feed the people, and people will be able to live, and Egypt will be able to continue. Pharaoh said, good idea. I wonder where I could find someone like that who has the wisdom, godly wisdom, to be able to do such a thing. Who else but you? You obviously have God with you. So he puts this Hebrew slave prisoner in charge of all of Egypt, second to no one other than Pharaoh himself. He gives him all his power. He gives him his signet ring. He parades him around in front of all the people of Egypt to say, this is my chosen. This is, when he speaks, that's me speaking, so listen to him. He gives him a very important wife, the daughter of the priest of Ra in the city of On. Gives him an Egyptian name, Zanaphath Paneah. Turns it over to him. Quite a thing for Pharaoh to do to a big nobody like this, but Pharaoh trusts him, and Joseph does that. In the end of chapter 41, we see what Joseph does. The first 7 years of his job for Pharaoh, we see in verse 47, during the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding that city. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain, like the sand of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. So these years of abundance were great, and the 20% that he collected was just tremendous. But there were going to be 7 years of famine, so he needed it to be tremendous. How did Joseph know when to stop collecting and start distributing the grain? Well, obviously after the 7 years, but verse 55, we see that when all Egypt, well, starting in 53, the 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food because of what Joseph had done. When all of Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told the Egyptians, go to Joseph and do what he tells you. Okay? So the people knew that the food was there, and Joseph knew it was time to start distributing once those people ran out of their own food and started needing the food that he had stored up. So how did he do that? How did he distribute the grain? Did he give it? Did it give an allotment to each Egyptian, or how did that work? Well, going on. When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. So he sold grain. So he built up the coffers and built up the riches of the government of Egypt. And going on in verse 57, and all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the world. So the famine was not just in Egypt, but it was everywhere. And people came from all over to buy grain. So Joseph not only made Egypt rich by the Egyptians, but made Egypt rich by all the other people of the earth, the other countries around that were affected by the famine who were coming to buy grain. Well, they spent their money, but eventually they're going to run out of money. There's 7 years, which is a long time. So what did Joseph do to help feed the people when they ran out of money? We see that back in chapter 47, verses 14 to 16. Joseph collected all the money that was to be found in Egypt and Canaan in payment for the grain they were buying, and he brought it to Pharaoh's palace. When the money of the people of Egypt and Canaan was gone, all of Egypt came to Joseph and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? Our money is gone. Our money's used up." "Well," said Joseph, "then bring me your livestock. I will sell you food in exchange for your livestock since your money is gone." So he took their livestock as payment for Pharaoh. So Pharaoh now had huge herds and flocks that he had collected from the people. Well, what happened when they ran out of livestock? And buying their livestock helped them too, because the livestock wouldn't be eating the grain and wouldn't be eating the grass that isn't there during this famine. So that kind of helped the people there too. What happened when they ran out of livestock? Going on. When that year was over, okay, so that livestock approach lasted a year, but when that year was over, they came to him the following year and said, "We cannot hide from our Lord the fact that since our money is gone and our livestock belongs to you, there's nothing left for our Lord except our bodies and our land. Why should we perish before your eyes, we and our land as well? Buy us. Buy our land in exchange for food. And we, with our land, will be in bondage to Pharaoh. Give us seed so that we may live and not die, so that the land may not become desolate." So they came to Joseph and said, "Turn us into slaves. Take our land. Take everything that we own. Just let us live. Help us live. You've got the ability to help us live." Going on. So Joseph bought all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh. The Egyptians, one and all, sold their fields because the famine was too severe for them. The land became Pharaoh's, and Joseph reduced the people to servitude from one end of Egypt to the other. Okay, so you can see the strength of Egypt is getting even stronger, and all the people are dependent upon Joseph and Egypt through this. Well, what happened when the famine was over? Going on, Joseph said to the people, "Now that I've bought you and your land today for Pharaoh, here is seed for you so that you can plant the ground. But when the crop comes in, give a fifth of it to Pharaoh. The other four-fifths you may keep as seed for the fields and as food for yourselves and your households and your children." "You've saved our lives," they said. "May we find favor in the eyes of our Lord. May we will be in bondage to Pharaoh." So Joseph established it as a law concerning land in Egypt. It's still in force today, whenever this was written, that a fifth of the produce belongs to Pharaoh. So Joseph gave them food to eat through those 7 years. After those 7 years were up, and he knew that those 7 years were up and the land would now be able to produce again because God had promised it would be the 7 years, he then gives out some extra grain for seed, for them to take and to grow the crops and to start replenishing not only their own food, but the food of Pharaoh. He sets up this law that 20% of the grain that's raised, or the produce, would be given to Pharaoh. And that was a long-lasting law. Okay, so that's how Joseph saved the world from this famine. The job that he had and how he fulfilled that job. And you see that God blessed him. God made him successful in that job, just as he had made him successful in the jobs in prison, in the job in Potiphar's household. Everything that he did wholeheartedly, as if he were working for God, and God blessed him with success through that. Okay? We're also called to work wholeheartedly for those for whom we work. And look to God to bless us through that. Okay, well, what about all these stories about Joseph? Why do we have these stories? It's interesting stories to see how this Hebrew, this descendant of Abraham, came and saved Egypt. But you know, the Bible's not about Egypt. The Bible's about God and God's people and God revealing himself to his people. Why do we have all these stories? What does this have to do with this family in back in Canaan, Abraham, Isaac, now Jacob, and his sons? What does it have to do with that covenant family? Okay. Well, going on, chapter 42. when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other? Okay? Why are you sitting around on your hands? Why are you just standing around? We got to do something. We're running out of food." He said, "I've heard that there's grain in Egypt. Go down there, buy some for us so that we can live and not die." Well, then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. So the famine was not just Egypt. We see it was also in Canaan. And after a period of time, Jacob used up all of their food, and they needed more food. And where do you get it? Hey, I hear there's some food in Egypt. Go get some. Okay, take some money and go buy some. But he didn't send all of his sons. He sent all of them except for Benjamin. Benjamin is now his favorite son. Joseph was his favorite son until Joseph was no more. Benjamin is who? Benjamin is the full brother of Joseph, the second son, the only other son of Rachel, the wife that Jacob loved. So here he doesn't want anything bad to happen to his son Benjamin as had happened to his son Joseph. So he protects him, and he does not let him go down to Egypt just to go buy some food with all of his brothers. We know, but his brothers don't know, that he may have the opportunity to come, they may have the opportunity to come face to face with their long lost brother that they sold as a slave. As far as they know, he's dead, or he's working as who knows what kind of slave, who knows where, but that would be it. There's no way anything else could have happened to him, because he's a Hebrew in Egypt, and once a slave there, always a slave there. So, did they get to see their long-lost brother? Going on. Now, Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all of its people. So, when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "Well, from the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Okay? Why not? And why did Joseph recognize him? Well, Joseph recognized him because when he left, he was the youngest except for Benjamin. Right? Benjamin was only about 1 or 2 years old at the time. Joseph was 17, 18, somewhere in there. 19, he was a teenager. He was a young man. This was a number of years later. But his brothers were all older, so they had been in their 20s when he left, so they would still look very similar to what they looked, you know, maybe a little bit different, a little more aged, but they would still be recognizable as who they were. Joseph, on the other hand, had been a teenager. He had been a Hebrew, okay? Now, he is an Egyptian. Egyptians were clean-shaven, not bearded. He was wearing Egyptian clothes. He was speaking Egyptian. He had an Egyptian name. He was an Egyptian official. Even if he looked just like Joseph to his brothers wouldn't have thought anything of it other than, hey, that guy looks like Joseph did, you know. They would not have thought anything that this guy could even possibly remotely be their brother Joseph. So they didn't recognize him at all. Joseph was now in his upper 30s, where he had left when he was about 17, 18, 19, so he would have looked a lot different as well. So did Joseph, recognizing his brothers and remembering the horrible things that they had done to him, did he take advantage of the situation and take revenge against his brothers? Going on, verse 9. Then he remembered his dreams about them. What dreams? The dreams of them bowing down to him. And guess what? What are they doing right now? They're bowing down to him. He remembered his dreams about them and said, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more." Joseph said to them, It is as I told you. You are spies. So, did he take advantage of the situation and try to take revenge? Well, it looks like it at first glance. He accuses them of being spies. They're getting upset. They're being accused by the second in command of all of Egypt of being spies. What happens to someone like that? They are no more. And so who knows what's in store for them. So they're afraid. So is Joseph taking revenge on them? It looks like it, but no. We'll see this, and you'll see this more as we get deeper into the story. You can look ahead to chapter 43, verse 7. And this is the brothers talking back to their dad later on. He says, they replied, "The man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family. Is your father still living?" he asked us. "Do you have another brother?" We simply answered his questions. How were we to know that he would tell us to bring our brother back down there? By taking this point of being in charge and accusing them of being spies, he's able then to ask them all sorts of questions and learn more about his family, learn more about his dad, learn more about how things are going on for them and have gone on for them over these years. But we also see, as we get further into the story, that he's also giving them a chance to come clean. Okay? He puts them in a number of situations that helps them recognize their sin, recognize what they had done to their brother, and confess it and repent of it and be forgiven of it. And you'll see that as we keep going on here. So we don't see, at first it looks like he's trying to take revenge, but as you see his actions continue, he's not. And he's not trying to harm them in any way. Rather, he's trying to restore them. How did Joseph build on this accusation of them being spies to see if his brothers had changed, if they had repented, if they are different people? Going on, verse 15. "And Joseph said, 'This is how you'll be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison so that your words may be tested to see if you're telling the truth. If you're not, as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies.' And he put them all in custody for 3 days. On the third day," so he gives them 3 days to think about it. 3 days, they're thinking they're dead men. They're thinking that they have no hope. "On the third day, Joseph says to them, 'Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, as you say, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring back your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die.' And this they proceeded to do." So he first told them they would all have to stay in prison except for one who would go back and get his brother. But then after 3 days he changes that and makes it much more lenient and says, "You can all go except leave one here." And he's kind of my collateral here. And y'all go back and then come back and bring your youngest brother. So why did the brothers think that this was happening to them? Going on. Verse 21, "They said to one another, 'Surely we're being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was.'" And they're talking about Joseph, obviously. "We saw how distressed he was when he was pleaded with us for his life, but we wouldn't listen. That's why this distress has come to us." Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." Okay? So they see these horrible things happening to them right now, this trouble that they've gotten into, as being a direct result of something that happened 15 to 20 years ago. Why are they still thinking about that? You see this guilt that has hung on their shoulders all these years. You see that they recognize this. Joseph's seeing this. Now they're saying all this in front of Joseph. Why are they saying this kind of stuff in front of Joseph? Well, because Joseph is an Egyptian. They don't know this guy can speak Hebrew, that this guy can understand them speaking. So they're speaking, not expecting him to understand what they're saying. Did Joseph get a chance to hear his brother's remorse? Well, I kind of told you that. Verse 23, "They didn't realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. So when he spoke to them, he spoke in Egyptian and used an interpreter to speak Hebrew to them. So they were thinking this was just an Egyptian official, and they didn't think anything of that. But Joseph heard what they had to say. In verse 24, he turned away from them and began to weep. But then he turned back and spoke to them again. He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. Okay, so he didn't let them choose which one was going to stay. He chose. And he chose Simeon. Why Simeon? Who was Simeon? Simeon was the second oldest. Who was the oldest? Reuben. What had Reuben done? Reuben had stood up for Joseph. Reuben was the reason Joseph wasn't dead. The brothers wanted to kill him. Reuben had given the idea to just throw him in a pit, and Reuben was going to save him. And maybe he had even commented to Joseph about that when all this was going on. But Simeon was the oldest who had taken part in what had happened to him. So he grabs the oldest that had taken part in that, and Simeon was the one who was thrown into prison. How do we then see that Joseph had forgiven his brothers and wasn't seeking revenge? Going on, verse 25. Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack, and to give them provisions for their journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys and left. Okay? So here, Joseph cares for them. We see that. He not only sends them all back other than one for collateral, but he gives them the grain and gives their money back. He doesn't tell them. He just puts the money in the pouches and sends it back. So you see he cares about his brothers. He just wants to see their repentance. He wants to see them be restored. Well, what did the brothers think when they found the silver in their packs? Going on, verse 27. At the place where they stopped for the night, one of them opened a sack to get some feed for his donkey. And he saw his silver in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, "My silver has been returned. Here it is in my sack." Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other trembling and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" Why would they be upset that they got their money back? Because they would be accused. They would look like they had stolen this. They'd look like they had stolen the grain or stolen their money back. And they're already in big trouble. Their brother's in prison. They're already in big trouble with this superhead honcho of Egypt. And now it's just getting worse and worse as the day goes by. Well, they go on. They go on back home rather than turning around. We'll deal with this problem later is kind of their approach. And they go and they see their dad. And how does Jacob respond when the brothers tell him the story? Verse 29, when they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to him. They told the story. You can read the story there. And then in verse 35, after they tell the story, and they tell him that in verse 34, that the man told us, "Bring your youngest brother to me so that I will know that you're spies, and you're not spies but honest men. Then I will give your brother back to you and you can trade in the land." In verse 35, as they were emptying their sacks, there in each man's sack was the pouch of silver. Okay, it wasn't just the first brother who had found that, but now they all found it. And when they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. Their father Jacob said to them, "You have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me." Okay, so everything is going bad for Joseph as well. And how do the brothers feel about this? It's just horrible because they know that they're responsible for what had happened to Joseph. And now everything's working against their dad on this. Well, who steps up? Verse 37. Then Reuben said to his father, "You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care and I will bring him back." Okay, so Reuben stands up and says, "Look, Dad, you can count on me for Benjamin's safety. I will take him and I will make sure he comes back. And if something happens to him, if I'm not able to do that, and your son dies or whatever, then you can kill my sons." Okay, sounds like it's paying evil for evil, bad for bad. Would Jacob really want to kill his grandsons? No. Reuben is showing his seriousness here of wanting to take care of Benjamin. So does Jacob agree with that idea? Verse 38, Jacob said, "No, my son will not go down there with you. His brother's dead, and he's the only one left. Joseph is dead. The only other son that I care about," is kind of what it sounds like he's saying, "is the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you're taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow." So he refuses to let Benjamin go down to Egypt. No way. Eventually, though, Jacob has to reconsider. Going on. "Now the famine was still severe in the land. So when they had eaten all the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to him, 'Go back and buy us some more food.' But Judah," now we see Judah a lot more here, "Judah said to him, 'The man warned us solemnly, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. So if you'll send our brother along with us, we'll go down and buy food for you. But if you will not send him, we won't go down, because the man said to us, you will not see my face again unless your brother's with you.'" So they ran out of food again. It was time that they had to get more food. There was no choice. The only food was in Egypt. The only way for them to get food was to go to Egypt and go buy some more. But the brothers knew, "We can't do that unless you let Benjamin come with us." Jacob doesn't want to do that. Verse 6, "Why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man that you had another brother?" And then we have the verse 7 that we read before. Well, the man kept asking us these questions. How are we going to know that it would eventually lead to where he's requiring us to bring our brother down? Well, then Judah said to his father, "Send the boy along with me, and we'll go at once, so that we and you and our children may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety." Okay, instead of Reuben saying, "You can hold my sons responsible," Judah is saying, "You can hold me responsible. You can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. As it is, if we hadn't delayed, we could have gone and returned twice." So Judah steps up and Judah says, "Count on me. I will take care of him, and you can blame me if anything happens." So what did Jacob decide? Well, father said to them, "If it must be, then do this. Put some of the best products of the land in your gift and take them down to the man as a gift." Okay, some balm, some honey, some spices, some myrrh, some pistachio nuts, some almonds. Take some stuff down there that would be treats to him. "Take double the amount of silver with you, because you've got to return the silver that was put back into the mouths of your sacks. Perhaps it was a mistake. Then take Benjamin also. Go back to the man at once. And may God Almighty, El Shaddai, grant you mercy before the man, so that he will let your other brother and Benjamin come back with you. As for me, if I am bereaved, I'm bereaved." So he decided to let them go. He prayed to God. He asked God for their safe return. He sent them with extra gifts for the governor and double the silver for payment. But then he just resolved and said, "Okay, this is all we can do. So the rest is in God's hands. And if God wills for Benjamin and Simeon not to come back to me, then that's just the way it is, and I'll just have to deal with it." Okay? So that's his response. So they go. They go down to Egypt. As soon as the brothers reach Joseph, what happens? Verse 15, "So the men took gifts and double the amount of silver and Benjamin also. They hurried down to Egypt and presented themselves to Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, 'Take these men to my house, slaughter an animal, and prepare dinner. They are to eat with me at noon.' So the man did as Joseph told him and took the men to Joseph's house." Okay, so without saying anything, without explaining what he was doing, he had his chief servant take the brothers to his house and prepare this big meal. Now he sees Benjamin for the first time since, you know, Benjamin was a baby when he left. Now Benjamin is over 20, and he gets to see him for the first time this way. And so what does Joseph want? Well, Joseph wants to see him more. Joseph wants some personal time with his brothers, and especially with Benjamin. What about the brothers? What do the brothers think about being brought to this governor's house. Verse 18. Now the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, we were brought back here because of the silver that was put back in our sacks the first time. He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. So they went up to Joseph's steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house and said, please, sir, we came down here the first time to buy food, but at the place where we stopped for the night, we opened our sacks and each of us found his silver, the exact weight in the mouth of his sack. So we've brought it back with us. We've also brought additional silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put the silver back in our sacks. Okay, so they thought that they were being brought to Joseph's house because they had stolen this money, because the money was missing. And so they very quickly come clean. They go to the steward and confess right out and say, hey, this is what happened, and we brought it back. It's here with us. How does the steward respond? Verse 23. It's all right, he said. Don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver. And then he brought Simeon out to them. So now, these guys are scared to death. They're afraid they're going to lose their lives. They're afraid they're going to turn into slaves. They're afraid of all this. They're afraid for the safety of their brother Benjamin and getting him back safely. But things are starting to change, and it's real confusing to them. You know, their silver was in their sacks, but now the steward is saying the silver's not missing, that they got it. Okay? And then he brings Simeon out. And things are looking better here, but they are confused. Well, Joseph shows up for lunch. Verse 24, the steward took the men into Joseph's house and gave them water to wash their feet and provided fodder for their donkeys. They prepared their gifts for Joseph's arrival at noon because they had heard that they were to eat there. When Joseph came home, they presented to him the gifts that they had brought into the house, and they bowed down before him to the ground. So all those things that Jacob had them take, all these other special gifts for him. They bowed down to him again. Remember those dreams and all those dreams of been fulfilled another time with all the brothers bowing down before him, and they presented gifts to him. What was the most valuable gift that Joseph received from him? Going on, he asked them how they were. And then he said, how's your aged father you told me about? Is he still living? They replied, your servant, our father, is still alive and well. And they bowed low again to pay him honor. As he looked about and he saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, he asked, is this your youngest brother, the one that you told me about? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there. So now he sees Benjamin for the first time, and he's learning more about his family. His dad's fine. Things have been going okay for them. And now he sees Benjamin, and he just blurts something out real quick, but he can't contain himself any further. So he leaves the room and goes finds a place where he can be by himself and cries, because this is just too overwhelming for him. Well, things are confusing. This guy comes and asks a question and he rushes out. How do things become even more confusing? Verse 31, after he washed his face, he came out and controlling himself, he said, serve the food. They served him, Joseph, by himself, and the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that's detestable to Egyptians. So you see, even Joseph wasn't eating with the other Egyptians at this time. He ate by himself. The men had been seated before him in the order of their ages, from the firstborn to the youngest. Okay, so the servants seated him in the proper order. There's a dozen, there's 10 of them, right? Or 11 of them. And they look at each other in astonishment. How do they know? How do they know what our order is? When portions were served to them from Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as anyone else's. So they feasted and drank freely with him. Okay? So things were getting more and more confusing. They were seated in order of age. How did these Egyptians know? You know, I've heard of this Egyptian divination kind of stuff. Maybe that's what's going on. Plus, Benjamin was given 5 times as much food. That's kind of strange. You know, he gets special treatment at home from dad. Now he's getting special treatment from this Egyptian governor here. Well, okay, now's the time. Does Joseph reveal himself to his brothers? Or does he just let him go home, never to see him again? Chapter 44. Now, Joseph gave these instructions to the steward of his house. Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry, and put each man's silver in the mouth of his sack. Then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one's sack, along with the silver for his grain. And he did as Joseph had said. As morning dawned, the men were sent on their way with their donkeys. They had not gone far from the city when Joseph said to his steward, "Go after those men at once, and when you catch up with them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also uses for divination? This is a wicked thing you have done.'" So he does another silver in the pouch plan. This time he puts all the silver money back in their pouches as before, and this is double again. But he also has them hide his silver cup into Benjamin's pouch. And then he plants this in there and then sends his servants out to go accuse them of stealing his cup and then finding it and creating problems here. So what's he doing? Well, how do the brothers respond? Going on, when the servant caught up with him, they repeated these words to him, but they said, "Why does my Lord say such things? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver that we had found inside the mouths of our sacks. So why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If any of your servants is found to have it, he will die, and the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves." "Very well then," the servant said, "let it be as you say. Whoever is found to have it will become my slave. The rest of you will be free from blame." You see what the brothers offer here. They are so sure that they have not stolen this cup, because they haven't, but they don't know that the cup is there. They say, whoever has it should die, and the rest of us will be slaves. So they put this huge penalty on themselves. And the servant, that's not what he wants. And that's not, he says, okay, it'll be as you say, but he kind of twists what they say, and he says, whoever's bag we find it in, he'll be the slave, and the rest of you can go home. Okay? So you see a leniency here from that too. But you'll see the purpose where this is going. So what happened when the sacks were searched? Each of them quickly lowered his sack to the ground and opened it. Then the steward proceeded to search, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Okay? It was found in Benjamin's sack. The most important thing for these brothers is to get back safely with food and their brother Benjamin. And now Benjamin looks like he stole the governor's cup. They can't believe he did this, but it sure is obvious to these Egyptians who accused them of stealing the cup, and Benjamin's the one who would be taken as a slave. How can they deal with this? What do the brothers do in response? Judah replies, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We're now my Lord's slave. We ourselves and the one who is found to have the cup." Verse 13, at this they tore their clothes. Then they all loaded their donkeys and returned to the city. Joseph was still in the house when Judah and his brothers came in, and they threw themselves to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, "What is this you have done? Don't you know that a man like me can find things out by divination?" Judah replied, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We are now my Lord's slaves. We ourselves and the one who was found to have the cup." So Judah here is saying, we're now all your slaves. You can see, I'd rather be your slave than to go back and tell Dad that something happened to Benjamin. Okay? I can't face that. So did Joseph accept this? Verse 17, Joseph said, "Oh, far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you, go back to your father in peace." Okay? Only the guilty party is going to be punished here. All the rest of you are free. Well, that's not really all they wanted either. So who steps up on Benjamin's behalf? Verse 18. Then Judah, Okay? Now, you're seeing more and more of Judah now and how he's stepping up and how he's concerned with the family. He is the child of the covenant. We don't know that yet. We'll find that in chapter 49. But he is the one who the covenant will pass through, the covenant of Abraham to Isaac, to Jacob, and then to Judah. And now we see Judah stepping up, and he goes up to Joseph and says, "Please, my lord, let your servant speak a word to my lord. Don't be angry with your servant, though you're equal to Pharaoh himself. My lord, you asked his servants, us servants, do you have a father or brother? And we answered, we have an aged father, and there's a young son born to him in his old age. His brother is dead." Notice how they keep repeating this. It's such a hanging issue for them that they always repeat and mention that Joseph is dead. And this son, this brother, is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him. "Well, then you said to your servants, bring him down to me so I can see him for myself. And we said, the boy cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, the father will die. But you told your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. So when we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what the Lord had said. And our father said, go back and buy some more food. And we said, we can't go down. Only if our youngest brother is with us can we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Well, your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, he has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. So now, sir, if the boy is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with this boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant, me, I guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. So please, let your servant remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father." Now, you see his concern, and you see that he cannot bring himself to go and let this happen. His concern is different than before. His concern now is not, I don't want Dad to be mad at me, but rather, I don't want to upset Dad. I can't let this happen to my dad. He's thinking about someone else. He's no longer thinking of himself. He's repented. He's being restored here. Okay, what Joseph's been trying to do is happening here. I like Luther's quote here. "What would I not give to be able to pray before the Lord as Judah here interceded for Benjamin? For this is a perfect model of prayer. No, of the strong feeling that must underlie all prayer." So a great prayer that Judah gives, trying to plead for the safety and the return of Benjamin. Well, how much further does Joseph continue to push things? Chapter 45, verse 1. "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants, and he cried out, 'Have everyone leave my presence!' So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers." So he couldn't handle it anymore. The stuff that Judah was saying here was obviously filled with confession, repentance, remorse, and, he's ready for this restoration. Verse 2, "And Joseph wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it." Someone ran off and told Pharaoh's household, "Oh, you should hear what's happening to Zanaphath Paniah." They don't know who these people are. I don't know that Joseph's told his servants yet. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers weren't able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Okay, these things are just extremely confusing to these guys. It's been up and down, back and forth. Just they don't know what to think. And now, this Egyptian governor who's accused him of being spies, of accused him of being thieves, who's wanting to take Benjamin and make him a slave, here, he gets everybody out and he starts crying and bawling. And then he claims that he's Joseph. He said, Joseph, this is an Egyptian guy. It doesn't make any sense. So How does Joseph make it clear to them that he's forgiven them and held no grudges? Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." Okay, this guy was an Egyptian governor, so they couldn't have been real close to him before. They had to keep their distance. But he says, "Come close to me." When they'd done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one that you sold into Egypt. And now, don't be distressed, and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here." Okay? Don't be upset. Don't be afraid. Because it was to save lives that God sent me here ahead of you. For 2 years now there's been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be plowing or reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. And you see how quickly Joseph recognizes his calling and what God's got him in place for, and how all these things in his life have led to what he's doing, and that this is all God's work, that God has taken the horrible things that happened to him, things that God wouldn't want to have happen, but God's taken those and turned them to his good, to accomplish his good, to accomplish the saving of many lives, to accomplish the saving of his family's lives. Okay? And Joseph says, don't be afraid and don't be upset with yourself for what you've done, because God's using that for good. So, what other plans does Joseph have here then? Going on. Verse 8. "So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, the lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now, hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you, your children and grandchildren, your flocks and herds, and all that you have. I will provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute." Okay? So go back, get Dad, get everybody, get everything, and come on back, and I'll get a place here for you, and I'll take care of you, because you're not going to be able to keep living in Canaan. And God has sent me here to prepare this way for you to come here. It goes on, "You can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it's really me that's speaking to you. Tell my father about all the honor accorded me here in Egypt and about everything that you've seen, and bring my father down here quickly." And he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept. And Benjamin embraced him, weeping. And he kissed all of his brothers. It's not just Benjamin, all his brothers, and wept over them. And then afterwards, his brother talked with him, so they got a chance to talk. When the news reached Pharaoh's palace that Joseph's brothers had come, Pharaoh and all his officials were pleased. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Hey, tell your brothers, do this. Go load your animals, return to the land of Canaan, and bring your father and your families back to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you can enjoy the fat of the land. Now, you're also directed to tell him to do this. Take some carts from Egypt for your children and your wives, and get your father and come. Never mind about your belongings, because the best of all Egypt will be yours." So the sons of Israel did this. Joseph gave them carts as Pharaoh had commanded, and he gave them provisions for their journey. So this is not just Joseph doing it, but Pharaoh. Joseph could have done all this, but here he's got the blessing of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's doing this on his own accord. "To each of them he gave new clothing, but to Benjamin he gave 300 shekels of silver, which is about 7.5 pounds of silver, and 5 sets of clothes. And this is what he sent to his father. 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and other provisions for his journey. Then he sent his brothers away. And as they were leaving, he said to them, don't quarrel on the way. Don't argue on the way. So he has this plan to have his dad and have the whole family come down to Egypt, take care of them, provide them. And he not only sends his brothers back to go get Jacob and everything, but he sends them with all these gifts to make it clear to Jacob that this really is true. Because if the brothers come back and say, hey, we saw Joseph, Joseph wants us to come see him, Jacob's not going to want to leave. And so Joseph sends this stuff with him. And Joseph recognized that he was put in place to get his father and the family down to Egypt Joseph was seeing for the purpose of saving them from this horrible famine. But there's more to it than that, that Joseph's not remembering, but in our hindsight we remember back in Genesis 15 when God makes his covenant, the blood covenant with Abraham. He tells him in verses 13 and 14, he says, "Then Yahweh said to him, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years, but I will punish that nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions." So this is part of God's plan of preparing his people. He's bringing his chosen people out of the promised land that they do not own yet. He hasn't given it to them yet. And they are going to be living in this foreign land for 400 years, and or they'll be servants for 400 years in preparation for what God's got in store for them. And so this is what God's using. Joseph's story is what God uses to get his chosen family down to Egypt for this incubation period to prepare them and turn them into a great nation. So they go back to Jacob. They tell Jacob all this. How does Jacob respond? Back to chapter 45, verse 25. "So they went up out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. They told him, 'Joseph is still alive. In fact, he's the ruler of all Egypt.' Jacob was stunned. He didn't believe him. Of course not. No way. But when they told him everything Joseph had said to him, and when he saw the carts that Joseph had sent to carry him back, the spirit of Jacob was revived, and Israel said, 'I'm convinced. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" Okay, Jacob's getting old here, and God is blessing him with a chance to see his beloved son, and with the knowledge that his son is not dead after all, had not been eaten by a ferocious animal, that he is there, and he's going to get a chance to see him. So he's thrilled at this opportunity. But for him to go to Egypt, that means he's leaving Canaan. That means he's leaving Bethel, Hebron. He's leaving God's land, the promised land. Okay, remember when Jacob left before to go up to Paddan Aram to find, to find a wife among his family, to run away from Esau, according to his mom. God encountered him there at Bethel and told him, "Don't worry, I'm going to be with you on your journey. You're not leaving me when you leave this land. I'm always with you." Okay? Well, Jacob certainly had some concerns about leaving, because in those days, when you went from one land to another land, you were leaving the god of one land and going to the god of another land. Whatever land you were in, you were to worship that god, to please that god. And when you left that god had no impact on you any longer. So, how does God deal with this? Chapter 46. "So, Israel, Jacob, set out with all that was his. And when he reached Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac." Beersheba is, remember, in the southern part of Canaan as you're going into the desert. This is in the Negev, the dry area. "And God spoke to Israel in a vision at night and said, 'Jacob, Jacob.' 'Here I am,' he replied. 'I am God, the God of your father,' he said. 'Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes.'" You know, what more could he ask for? He's an old man. His life was full, but he's had this horrible life, mourning over the death of his son Joseph. But then he finds out Joseph is alive. He's going to go see him. And God tells him that, "I'm going to be with you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to turn you into a great nation. You're going to see Joseph. Not only will you see him, but he'll be there as you take your last breath." Okay? So God gives him all these blessings, and God tells him he's going to be with him. So, Jacob leaves Beersheba, verse 5, "And Israel's son took their father Jacob and their children and their wives and the carts that Pharaoh had sent them to transport them. They also took with them their livestock and the possessions they acquired in Canaan, and Jacob and all of his offspring went to Egypt. He took with him to Egypt his sons and grandsons and his daughters and his granddaughters, all of his offspring." So you see that he wasn't planning on just visiting. He was moving. He took everything. Didn't leave anything behind that was of value to him. We then go on verses 8 through 25. We see all the people who were part of this family at the time. Okay, the wives, the sons, their wives or their children. Really, what you see here is the list, not necessarily the wives, but all the children and grandchildren. You see all those with the blood of the family. Okay, the blood of Jacob. And if you add it up in those verses, you see in verse 26, it says, all those who went to Egypt with Jacob, those who were his direct descendants, not counting his sons' wives, numbered 66 persons. So there were 66 going down. But going on, with the two sons who had been born to Joseph, so they would have Jacob's blood in them, and Joseph himself, right? The members of Jacob's family which went to Egypt were 70 in all. So you've got 66 plus Jacob, make 67, plus Joseph is 68, plus Joseph's two sons that he had in Egypt, Ephraim and Manasseh. So 70, this group that goes down to Egypt at this time is 70. If you contrast that with Exodus chapter 12, when they leave, you know, how large does this family grow over the next 430 years? Chapter 12, verse 37. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. And the length of time the Israelites had lived in Egypt was 430 years. So 600,000 men, that doesn't count the women, doesn't count the children, it doesn't count the ones who didn't leave. Some of the Israelites didn't leave and stayed in Egypt. So you're talking 2 to 3 million plus is what this group of 70 turned into over the course of those years. Okay, so they go down. Jacob gets to see Joseph for the first time in 20 years. How does he react? Well, how would you expect he would react when he sees his favorite son after so long? Verse 28, now Jacob sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to get directions to Goshen. When they arrived in the region of Goshen, Joseph had his chariot made ready and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as Joseph appeared before him, he threw his arms around his father and wept for a long, long time. So not only was Jacob, Israel, excited about seeing Joseph, but Joseph was especially excited to see his dad. Every time he saw his brothers, he had asked his brothers, how's your father? Okay, how is he? He was concerned for him. Israel said to Joseph, now I am ready to die, since I've seen for myself that you are still alive. Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and speak to Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and my father's household who are living in the land of Canaan have come to me. These men are shepherds. They tend livestock and they brought along their own flocks and herds and everything they own. And when Pharaoh calls you in and asks, what's your occupation? You should answer, your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on, just as our fathers did. That way you will be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, which is the best of the land. But it's also the best for the flocks and herds. But you'll be able to settle there because it's away from the Egyptians, and all shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians. So Joseph went and told Pharaoh, my father and brothers and all their flocks and herds and everything they own have come from the land of Canaan and are now in Goshen. He chose five of his brothers, presented them before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh asked him, you know, what's your occupation? Your servants are shepherds, they replied to Pharaoh, just as our fathers were. They also said, we've come to live here a while because of famine is severe in Canaan and your servants' flocks have no pasture, so please, let your servants settle in Goshen. Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you in the land of Egypt. Before you settle your father and your brothers in the best part of the land, let them live in Goshen. And if you know any among that have special ability, well, put them in charge of my own livestock. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him before Pharaoh. After Jacob blessed Pharaoh, Pharaoh asked him, how old are you? Jacob said, the years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers. Then Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers in Egypt and gave them property in the best part of the land, the district of Ramses, as Pharaoh directed. Joseph also provided his father and his brothers with all his father's household and all his father's household with food according to the number of their children. So he gave them land, the best land of Egypt, fed them, took care of them. So we have this great emotional reunion. Jacob feels his life is now complete, and Joseph takes care of them. They get through this this famine and have a home. Have a home where they're welcome. Okay. We then have the next verses that we've already read about how Joseph continued to manage things during the famine. And then after that, we see that Jacob asks something of Joseph. Verse 27. Now the Israelites settled in Egypt in the region of Goshen. They acquired property there and were fruitful and increased greatly in number. Jacob lived in Egypt 17 years, for the years of his life were 147. When the time drew near for Israel to die, he called for his son Joseph and said to him, "If I found favor in your eyes, put your hand under my thigh." It's kind of weird. We've seen that before with Abraham. "And promise that you will show me kindness and faithfulness. Do not bury me in Egypt, but when I rest with my fathers, carry me out of Egypt and bury me where they're buried." "I will do as you say," he said. "Swear to me," he said. Then Joseph swore to him, and Israel worshipped as he leaned at the top of his staff. So he asked Joseph to bury him, and we'll see, this is where? Well, in the family cave, in the family grave, in Machpelah's cave over in near Mamre, where Abraham and Isaac and all of his parents or grandparents are buried. So did Joseph do this? Well, in chapter 50, verse 7, we see that, we're zooming by some stuff. In chapter 48 and 49, we have blessings from Jacob. In 48, we see a story about Jacob blessing Joseph's sons. And this is where we see, again, as we've seen in every generation so far in this family, that the blessing, the top blessing, does not go to the oldest son, but instead to a different one. And Jacob goes to bless the two sons and give the better blessing to the second son. Joseph tries to correct him, and Jacob says, no, this is the way it is. And so he gives him blessings. And he also says, Joseph, your sons are like my sons. They each will receive a portion of my inheritance, a portion of my blessing. Okay? They'll be treated just as any of my other sons. Okay? So he gives them that. Then in chapter 49, we've got these great blessings that Jacob gives to his sons. And a lot of these blessings foretell what his sons' descendants, what the tribes become. So as we get more into the story of the Israelite tribes, come back and look at this chapter, and you'll see it turned out just as he prophesied here. And then in verse 29 of chapter 49, then he gave him these instructions. "I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre in Canaan, that Abraham bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite along with the field. There Abram and his wife Sarah were buried, as well as my parents Isaac and Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. Now the field and the cave in it were bought from the Hittites." When Jacob had finished giving instructions to his son, he drew his feet up into his bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. So we see that that Jacob died. Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him for 70 days. Big mourning, the father of the second in command of all of Egypt. When the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, "If I found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me. Tell him, my father made me swear an oath and said, I'm about to die. Bury me in the tomb that I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. So let me go up and bury my father, and then I will return." Let me go on this trip, this not a vacation, but this trip. And that's a concern, because whenever someone left a town like that, or left a country, would they come back? You know, are they leaving? We'll see this when we talk about the Exodus. That's one of the concerns. If they leave, then they're gone, kind of thing. But verse 6, Pharaoh said, "Go up, bury your father, as he made you swear to do." So Joseph went up to bury his father. All of Pharaoh's officials accompanied him. So it wasn't just Joseph and his brothers. This was the whole family, as well as all these officials, the dignitaries of the court and the dignitaries of Egypt, besides all the members of Joseph's household and his brothers and those belonging to his father's household. Only the children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very, very large company. When they reached the threshing floor of Atad near the Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly, and there Joseph observed a seven-day period of mourning for his father. When the Canaanites who lived there saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "The Egyptians are holding a solemn ceremony of mourning." That's why this place near the Jordan was called Abel Mitzrayim, which Mitzrayim means Egypt, and Abel Mitzrayim means the mourning of the Egyptians. So Jacob's sons did as he had commanded, and they carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which Abram had bought from as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite, along with a field. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all the others who had gone with him to bury his father. Okay, so we see that Joseph was there when his father died. Joseph then took him, and Jacob was buried along with his father and his grandfather, his mother, his grandmother, and his wife Leah. Not Rachel. Rachel had been buried outside of Bethlehem, and she died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin. But he goes to the family tomb and buries him there. And then they all come back to Egypt. Now that Dad's gone, the brothers have a concern. What would they be concerned about? Verse 15 of chapter, we're now in chapter 50. When Joseph's brother saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you're to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive the sins of your, forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs that they committed in treating you so badly. Now, please forgive the sins of your servants, of the God of your father." So they're concerned what Joseph might do now that Dad's out of the picture. You know, what was Esau's plan when his dad was out of the picture? He was going to kill Jacob. Now that Jacob is dead, Joseph's brothers are concerned, okay, now that Dad's gone, there's nothing that's keeping him protecting us. So let's tell him that Dad wanted him to protect us. Joseph got this message, and he cried. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We're your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what's now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and for your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. So they were naturally concerned about their well-being, but Joseph put that to rest. And he gave that great quote in verse 20. "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." That's the key verse of the story of Joseph. It's a key verse for a lot of bad things that happen in our lives. God can take that bad stuff and can turn it to his good. Joseph's life was full of bad stuff. Every time he turned around, something undeservedly wrong happened to him, but yet he continued to remain faithful to God. You see that in many examples of faith. The story of Job, the stories of many of the pillars of faith, they remain faithful to God. God uses them to accomplish his good, to accomplish his purpose. Joseph recognized that, and he told his brothers that. Okay, so you intended to harm me, but God used it for what's now being done, the saving of many lives. Okay? And then we have the end of the book. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with his father's family. He lived to be 110 years old and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Okay, and also the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knee. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid, and he will take you up out of this land to the land that he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. So here we see Joseph dies, and that closes the book of Genesis. He also wants to go to Canaan, even though he had spent most of his life, the vast majority of his life in Egypt as an Egyptian. His home was with his family, and he wanted to go with his family. He wanted to go back to Canaan when the God brought them out. And we'll see that when we get into the book of Exodus in a couple of weeks, that is exactly what happens. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank and praise you for the stories that you've given us. We thank you because we see so much about you and about your will and about your plan and the way that you work in our lives. We also see a lot about ourselves. We see a lot about how we react correctly or incorrectly to things that happen in our lives. We see that you can work through those things, the things that that we can't understand why something happens to us. But you can take those horrible things that happen in our lives and turn them for your good. Help us to see that. Help us to look for that good. Help us to always seek to serve you and to fulfill your purpose for our lives, just as Joseph did. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.